Greetings, one and all. Oh, have I got a couple of great stories for you tonight. They're both related to the following sound clip.
Looks good in there, Zoran. Roger.
VCS arm switch is on.
Okay, Victor.
Landing rocket arm switch is on. Here comes the throttle. Circuit breakers in.
We have separation.
Roger.
Inboard and outboard, they're on. We're coming forward with the side stick.
Oh, looks good.
Roger. I've got a blowout. Hammer 3.
Pitch your pitch to 0.
Pitch is out. I can't hold altitude.
Correction. Alpha hold is off. Troop selectors emergency.
Flight calm. I can't hold it. She's breaking up. She's breaking up.
Steve Austin, astronaut. A man barely alive. We can rebuild him. We have the technology. We can make him better than he was. Better. Stronger. Faster.
Well, anyone who grew up in the 1970s like me, or is addicted to cheesy old television shows, will recognize that immediately as being from The $6 Million Man, a TV show which followed the adventures of OSI cyborg, ex-astronaut, secret agent, Colonel Steve Austin. Along with Michael Crichton's book and the movie Terminal Man, these were the first SF stories to bring the idea of the cyborg into the broad eye of the mainstream public. By the 1980s, the Japanese became obsessed with the idea, and a huge proportion of their SF is still madly focused on the physical and psychological effects of having both brain and body parts replaced. Probably the most famous example of that is Masamune Shirow's Ghost in the Shell. Of course, the idea of a man with artificial parts replacing the original factory equipment obviously goes back much farther than that. Asimov and others covered it in the 1960s, and before that, stories from one of Tony's favorite authors, Alfred Bester, in The Stars of My Destination, covered the same ground. If you want to get really pedantic, probably the first actual SF story involving replacing body parts was, ta-da, yes, what we always come back to, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. After all, Frankenstein's monster was, after being rebuilt, although not quite as attractive as Steve Austin, stronger and faster than he was originally. So what is the point of my painfully inadequate SF history lesson on cyborgs? Well, recently there were two new stories that suggest that we are not far from an era when humans with prosthetics as sophisticated as Steve Austin's will walk among us, and that, at least according to the International Association of Athletics Federation, the IAAF, they already do. Oscar Pistorius is a world-class athlete, a 400-meter sprinter, who will be competing in the Olympics in August for South Africa. He is also a paraplegic, with both his lower limbs, below his thighs, replaced by carbon fiber prosthetics that resemble nothing more than black-bladed, high-tech leaf springs from your car. His legs are called Cheetah Flex Foot Prosthetics, and they're made by an Icelandic company called Össur. After doing well at international races earlier in the year, Oscar did not get the honor of being allowed to compete, even though he qualified, until also winning a serious battle in May with the IAAF and the International Olympic Committee involving his high-tech prosthetics. Oscar will not be the first paraplegic Olympic athlete, by the way. That honor goes to New Zealand's gold-medaling archer Neroli Fairhall, but Miss Fairhall was not running on artificial legs. She shot her bow from a sitting position. Also, she was not accused, like Oscar, of actually having an advantage over her opponents. Yes, you heard correctly. Double paraplegic Oscar was accused by the IAAF of having an advantage over his competitors. That is why they didn't want to let him compete. Now, we're not talking about Steve Austin electronically enhanced legs here that make Oscar superhuman. We are talking, to put it bluntly, high-tech peg legs attached to his stumps. So, what were the accusations of the IAAF? Well, it comes down to two points. Here is the first point, as stated by the actors from The $6 Million Man in this clip.
He's not even breathing hard.
Well, you see, his lungs are used to handling oxygen for the blood supply for two arms and two legs. Now we only have to take care of one.
Look, it's impossible.
Years ago, so was the 4-minute mile. The limits are here, Miss Manners. Here.
That arm, those legs of his will do anything, absolutely anything his mind tells him to. I think he's ready for us now.
There you have it. Does Oscar have an advantage over his competitors because his blood is not being pumped to his legs? Is he using less energy in a 400-meter sprint than his competitors and thus have an advantage? By the way, take this from a former high school sprinter. The 400-meter is a bitch of a run, since it is all out. It's just like a 100-meter dash, but it's four times the distance, and your muscles are stressed both aerobically and anaerobically to make energy, like you can't imagine. To get a world-class sprint time on the 400-meter, well below 50 seconds, the world record holder, Michael Johnson, 43.18 seconds, your body has to be in perfect condition. Well, Oscar's body is obviously not perfect, and yet he is competitive. Is it because he's cheating with his prosthetics? Well, that's what the IAAF claimed. They conducted a two-day scientific study of Oscar's prosthetics, led by German professor Gerd Peter Brueggemann. Afterwards, they concluded that Oscar uses 25% less energy than average runners due to his artificial limbs, therefore giving him an unfair advantage on the track. Is this true? Well, Oscar believed it was nonsense and had his own scientific study done with the help of Dr. Hugh Hare, an associate professor and biophysicist at MIT. Dr. Hare addressed the accusations. Now, remember what I said earlier about getting energy from two sources while running? Those two sources are aerobic and anaerobic. The aerobic pathway is used by muscle cells to break down glucose and burn it chemically to create energy in the form of adenosine triphosphate, ATP. The aerobic pathway is active when you have huge amounts of oxygen available in the muscle cells to help break down sugar. Now, anaerobic energy is created when the muscles are stressed for lack of oxygen. It's a pathway that allows small but significant amounts of ATP to be made under severe stress conditions. The IAAF claimed that they could measure both aerobic and anaerobic energy levels. Dr. Hare, on the other hand, says that you can only measure energy produced aerobically. Quote, anaerobic energy cannot be quantified by anyone, not here in the U.S., not in Germany. It simply can't be precisely quantified. Unquote. The IAAF claimed that they could quantify anaerobic energy, and they even put an exact number on it. That is where Oscar's 25% energetic advantage supposedly comes from at 400-meter race speeds. That value of 25% is simply absurd. Hare says the German studies are deeply flawed because you simply cannot quantify levels of anaerobic energy being used at those speeds. He concluded that no one can assess quantitatively whether there is or is not an advantage. Hare also points out that the German method used to determine how much anaerobic energy was being used by Oscar is just plain wrong. They measured the amount of lactate in the blood. Now, lactate is a substance that's produced when your muscles are starved for oxygen but still need to make energy. Lactate actually comes from an alternate energetic fermentation pathway that's similar to that in yeast that makes alcohol for beer and wine. Just not as much fun. Lactate buildup in stressed muscles accounts for your pain after a long run, a workout, or whatever kind of physical stress we're talking about. In the correct circumstances, the more lactate made and in the blood, the more energy was made anaerobically. Unfortunately, most physiologists don't accept that lactate blood measurement as being an accurate representation of anaerobic capacity when measuring a runner at high speed. The metabolic output is too great and too untrustworthy for just such a measurement to be believed. When you're running below a certain critical speed, all the energy produced is from aerobic sources. Well, what Air did was simply take all of his measurements below that critical speed so that the anaerobic measurements never even came into it. Hare found that when the aerobic energy is the only energy source available, Oscar and the other world-class athletes with intact legs showed no significant difference in energy consumption. And this makes perfect sense from a practical standpoint. Remember, we're not talking Steve Austin here, where his whole leg was replaced. Oscar's thigh muscles are intact. He uses up lots of aerobic and anaerobically supplied energy to push on those prosthetics. So the other accusation of the IAAF is that Oscar uses less energy than his competitors because his prosthetics spring back and return energy to his thigh stumps, thus reducing the energy needed for him to run. At least according to the IAF, there is little bounce back energy that comes from a human leg hitting the ground. The IAF calculated that Oscar's ankle springs would give him a, quote, mechanical advantage of the blade in relation to the healthy ankle joint of an able-bodied athlete that is higher than 30%, unquote. Well, Professor Hare responded to this in two ways. First, he indicated that there's no way to know how much of that returned energy actually went into the muscles and into motion, and how much is just transferred into heat energy and dissipated out of the springs like that. The IAF, on the other hand, insisted that the cheetah prosthetic transferred all the spring energy back into motion, unlike a human leg. But they didn't actually measure this. Additionally, Hare hypothesized that not all of the spring back energy is lost in a human leg. Some of it is transferred to the knee. In our body, we have muscles that span multiple joints. And biomechanics does suggest that one purpose of muscles that actually span multiple joints is so the body can transfer energy across joints. In short, it's entirely unclear that Oscar does have the advantage that the IAAF suggests. Additionally, Oscar may have a serious disadvantage over healthy world-class athletes. One of Dr. Hare's collaborators, Dr. Peter Wayland of Rice University, has found in biophysical studies that really fast people generate very high forces on the ground, and they do this very, very fast. Slow people simply cannot generate those high forces. Oscar's ground forces seem to be slightly lower than an athlete's with legs. That suggests that perhaps he might be force limited because of his prosthesis, because it's just a spring, and that he cannot generate the high forces an intact human leg can. So, this is obviously more complicated than the IAAF first thought. Okay, now for my editorial. In terms of competition, just what in the hell was the IAAF thinking? We are going to ban this guy because he is better than someone with two healthy legs. Well then, where will he compete? Against other handicapped runners in the Paraplegic Olympics? There is a Paraplegic Olympics. We have Paraplegic Olympics because we assume that paraplegics are athletes that are not as skilled because they are handicapped. Oscar can kick the collective asses of literally 99.999% of the world's population in a 400-meter run. Does that sound like he's handicapped? What happens when Oscar, or somebody like him, finally breaks the world record? Will they disallow it completely, or simply say that his record was mechanically enhanced, mechanically aided, and put it in the book with an asterisk? Oscar may not have an advantage now, as shown by those lab tests, but how long until somebody like him does have an advantage? How far off are we from a Colonel Steve Austin who can kick anybody's unenhanced ass in a race, a javelin throw, or a wrestling match? Then we will have to face up to the fact that you cannot simply ban a person from a sport. You have to give them alternatives. Whether Oscar had an advantage or not, where the IAF went wrong is that they wanted to ban him without giving him alternatives, without giving him someone at least as good as he is to compete against. You have to provide somewhere where everyone can compete. I say create a new World Olympics for this category. Not the Healthy Human Olympics, or the Paraplegic Olympics, or even the Special Olympics. Create the new Meta-Human Olympics. To complicate matters further, in the future, we will not just have cyborgs who want to be treated equally, but presumably, there will be genetically enhanced humans who are stronger, faster, etc. from birth. Where will they compete? Well, what do you think? I'm not sure that my idea is all that original, but it seems like it may be the only fair way to do this. Okay, my second cyborg news story will not take as much time up as the first did, since we don't want to cover the same ground. This is more of a tech story. Dr. Andrew Schwartz of the University of Pittsburgh and some of his collaborators at Carnegie Mellon University took a major step in the last few months in getting the brain to interact directly with prosthetic devices. And now, this is something that Rudy Wells from the $6 Million Man just kind of glossed over on the show 30 years ago. He never actually talked about the interfaces. Even if you look at the way the show was actually filmed, it was never obvious exactly the way you had these prosthetics connected, just that they kind of connected into the brain somewhere. It's actually not all that difficult now to build some very complicated limbs to help people walk and move, but the hardest part of the process is the interface. How do you command those limbs from the brain in an extremely accurate manner? Part of this overarching problem is how to create feedback loops to help control fine motor skills and the proprioceptic phenomenon that our own limbs provide. You are born knowing where your limbs are in space at all times and how they are moving, unless you have some major brain or nerve damage. Now, if you close your eyes and lift your right hand above your head, you still know exactly where your hand is. You can move it with your eyes still closed and pick up a pencil on the table in front of you. This feeling of where your body is located in space is called the proprioceptic sense. Schwartz's work comes one step closer to allowing that type of sense in an artificial limb by the use of heavy computation. Schwartz's group implanted macaque monkeys with electrodes in the motor cortexes of their brains. They then learned to control a robotic arm with their thoughts. They gently restrained the monkey's own arms. They didn't cut off any monkey arms. They let the monkeys keep their arms and just held them down so they couldn't use them. And then they positioned a mechanical arm at the animal's left shoulder like it was a real arm. After practicing for several days, the monkeys appeared to treat the robotic arm as their own and could feed themselves with the arms using quite fluid and rapid motions. This is seriously amazing. It's amazing because it took the monkeys so little time to learn how to use the arms. Other researchers have had little success at this type of experimental work. So what was Schwartz's secret? Well, we're not just talking about the monkey brain being directly connected to the limbs. It's more complex than that. If it was just electrical signals being sent from the motor cortex to the arms, it would be months, years, or maybe decades before the monkeys could move those arms at all. No, the electrodes were attached from the monkey brains to a high-speed computer and then to the mechanical arm. As the monkeys tried to move the arms, the computer would associate patterns of electrical activity in that particular brain region with the monkeys craving to reach toward pieces of food placed around them. The computer software then interpreted where the monkeys wanted to reach and whether they wanted to open or close the hands, based on the brain activity. The computer would then calculate the specific movements of the robotic arm, shoulder, and elbow joints to perform the task without the monkey having to think about those details. Rapid interpretation of the brain signals by the computer helped the robotic arm to move in a natural manner. The computer could convert the monkey's thoughts into movements of the robotic arm in about 150 milliseconds. That's amazing because it's about the nerve delay seen in a real arm. So when can injured Iraq war vets sign up to get Schwartz's amazing new system? Well, unfortunately not very soon. As with all new tech, there are major problems that still need to be overcome before human trials can even begin. First of all, Schwartz needed some serious computational power to allow the monkey limbs to be controlled. Amazing as it seems, in this day and age of nano iPods and PSPs, the size of the computers needed to do those calculations is still just too big. They're simply too impractical to be lugged around with an arm or a leg that will be used every day by somebody. Second, those electrodes that I mentioned earlier are not immune system friendly. Within a couple of weeks, the electrodes lost contact with the brain because the immune system attacked them as foreign bodies and pretty much made them useless after a relatively short time. But these are just technical problems. As any scientist will tell you, overcoming technical problems is just a matter of time and patience. Do not expect to see Steve Austin's limbs in the next couple of years, but do not be surprised if you do not see them regularly within the next decade. Not to sound stupidly hopeful, folks, but I can guarantee that will happen. Because the success of work like this is always a matter of how much money you throw at it. And right now, lots of grant money is being thrown at this problem. From where, you ask? Well, in the states where I live, most of the funding for this type of research comes, oddly, not from the National Institute of Health or the National Science Foundation, but from military sources. So many young soldiers have been crippled in the last few years fighting in the Middle East that it has become imperative to the U.S. military to help all those 20-something amputees. Now, we are talking tens of millions of available dollars to grantees with the right proposals. At first, this may seem amazingly selfless for the military-industrial complex that we in America have, but then the memory of Colonel Steve Austin comes niggling back into your mind, and you wonder cynically whether the multi-star generals are thinking the same thing. Wouldn't a squad of cyborgs, who were faster and stronger, with better eyesight and hearing, be a hell of a lot better than the unenhanced troops we have now? And no, nowhere in the grant application materials does the military actually mention actual military applications for advanced prosthetics. But, well, it is food for thought. I'm finished for the moment. Thanks for listening. As usual, take care, and I hope I have inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.